today I'm here with Yaron Brook, who is from the Ayn Rand Institute. Yaron, thanks and welcome.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background and where you came from?
Sure. I was born and raised in Israel served in the Israeli military, got my undergraduate degree over in Israel, and then moved to the United States in 1987. Got my MBA and then a PhD in finance, was a finance professor for 7 years, and then took this job at the Ayn Rand Institute. I've been president and executive director since 2000.
And you grew up in Israel?
I did.
So you're Jewish?
I grew up Jewish. I'm Jewish ethnically, I guess, culturally to some extent. I'm not religious.
Right. Now, I ask because I am, although I grew up in Australia, I am 10% genetically Ashkenazi Jewish. My grandmother was 43% and found out, we already knew this, but we found out the exact details through genetic testing, which was pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting when you do the genetic stuff, it's interesting. But of course, what difference does it make? We are who we are as individuals.
So tell us about what you do at the Ayn Rand Institute.
So the Institute itself it exists to promote Ayn Rand's ideas. It exists to bring Ayn Rand's ideas into the culture, into the mainstream, and ultimately to have a positive impact on the world, to change the world, to change the culture, to bring about a culture of a reason, self-interest, and ultimately capitalism. We have a wide variety of programs focused anywhere from high schools, college students, young professionals. We educate people about her ideas. We try to get people to read her books. We do a lot of kind of think tank type stuff. We publish articles about how to the application of her ideas to the world out there, to current events, to politics, to really the what's going on in the world. So I both run the Institute as the CEO in terms of the organization. We have today over 50 employees and a budget in excess of $10 million annually. And I'm the primary spokesman for the Institute. So I spend a lot of my time doing interviews like this, but also speaking in front of student groups, business groups, intellectual groups, a variety of different audiences, writing. I've got a new book out that came out in September called Free Market Revolution, How Ayn Rand's Ideas Can End Big Government. So I have a, in a sense, an administrative responsibility of running the Institute and organizing and raising money for it and so on, and a responsibility qua public spokesman, intellectual, as a writer, speaker, and advocate for these ideas.
So, I mean, why do all this? You're a smart guy. I think anyone who's really gotten into Ayn Rand understands intellectually how to do business and how to get things done. And you don't need to do this. I mean, you could be off working your way up to being a billionaire rather than doing what you're doing. So why do this?
Well, because I love it. It's a lot of fun, and I truly enjoy what I do. And because I care about the world I live in. I care about the world in which we live. I care about my kids. I want to live in a better world. I want my kids to live in a better world. I want good people to live in a better world. I think I benefit from it. I think everybody that I care about would benefit from that. And I'm a fighter. I want to fight for that better world. So I'm passionate about the ideas. I'm passionate about the philosophy. I'm passionate about conveying those ideas and conveying that philosophy. And I think that I enjoy the process of teaching and enjoy the process of communicating with people. I get a kick out of being able to stimulate thought in other people's minds. I love the idea, that light that comes on in somebody's eyes when they get something for the first time. So I enjoy the process, and the end result is an end result that's very, very important to me. These ideas that changed my life, that have profound influence on the way I lived my life. And I think that these ideas can change the culture, the world in which we live, and I've dedicated, my life, at least the rest of my life, to fighting for those ideas.
But Ayn Rand is one of, she's critiqued as her writing is poor quality, and I mean, I'm a big fan, and I think her writing is not always that great. And she's by the left, certainly, she's got to be one of the most hated people in the U.S. You're putting yourself in a pretty controversial spot to be fighting for that sort of stuff.
What could be more fun than that? So I disagree with you about her writing. I think her writing's brilliant, and I think her novels are a brilliant quality literature. But I'm not a literature expert, so I concede that people disagree about these things. But look, yeah, the world disagrees with you. The world thinks these ideas are wrong. The world thinks Ayn Rand is wrong. But that's the challenge. The challenge is, how do we convince people? How do we change people's minds? How do we communicate these ideas in a ways that shows the truth behind these? And it's a fun challenge. It's an interesting challenge. It's a frustrating challenge often because, it's hard. But that's part of what makes this interesting. If this was easy, I'd probably go to Wall Street and try to become a billionaire. You know, that would be challenging and that would be interesting. So the fact that it's challenging, the fact that it's interesting, the fact that it's fun, and I go up against really smart people who disagree with me, and that makes it interesting and fun. So the fact that people don't agree with me doesn't make or break this proposition. It doesn't change it doesn't change for me the truth of what I'm fighting for and why I'm fighting for it.
Right. And so I want to tell you about when I read Atlas Shrugged. I got it maybe 4 or 5 years before, put it on my bookshelf and just kept it gathering dust, and it literally was. A friend had told me about it, and I'd started reading it, but it, I mean, the beginning was a little dry and I couldn't get into it. And then I was going through a time where everything was falling apart, like literally everything. And a second friend was like, look, you need to go and read this. And I was like, well, you know, everything is a total train wreck. I'll take the weekend off and I'll go and start reading it. And I managed to get through. And I found the first about 100 pages a little bit tough to get through. Once I got through those, it was like, oh, my God, this stuff is making sense. I'm seeing all these things I never saw before. I felt it was like my brain was being rewired. It's so many things started to become more clear. I had probably a different reaction than most people because you want to know what I did next?
No.
I booked a trip to Cuba.
Okay.
I was living in the Caribbean and working online remotely, which is something that worked well up. Prior to reading Atlas Shrugged, worked not very well. Post reading Atlas Shrugged, worked really well. No, but I realized I had a pretty unique opportunity because I speak Spanish, I understand Latin culture very well. I've been down there for 10 years, and I was like, you know what? Now that I see the capitalistic side, and I've always supported capitalism, I want to go and see the world that empathy creates.
Yep.
And it was absolutely astonishing and astounding. And I don't know if you've talked to many people who've been to places like Cuba, but it was really interesting.
Well, yes, I've talked to a lot of people who've been to places like Cuba. And I grew up in Israel, which at the time was quite socialist, quite oppressive if you were in business, so if you had any aspirations on the from a business perspective. And I grew up a socialist. My story of Atlas Shrugged is a little different because I grew up as a socialist. I grew up as a collectivist. I grew up as an altruist. Everything Ayn Rand is against, to a large extent, I was taught that those are the truth. And so when I read Atlas Shrugged, it was like, this can't be true. This is nonsense. She can't be right. I fought it. I argued with her on every page. It took me months to read because I wasn't convinced. I fought it. And she had to literally walk me through it, through the book, and convince me of the truth of her ideas. And by the end, I was 100% convinced. But I'd experienced both internally, inside myself, what it meant to believe in socialism, altruism, collectivism, and what a culture that believes in that is like. So I didn't feel like I had to go to Cuba to know what socialism produces, because I felt like I knew it in a sense in my soul.
Hmm. When I was in Cuba, two things that were really profoundly interesting. One was seeing some friends gave me a list of questions to ask the Cubans, and one of the questions was, "What do you think Cuban is the strongest point of Cuba that's most should be most renowned for?" And they said that they said our empathy, which I thought was pretty interesting. And the second was, obviously, there's a lot of dilapidation and problems there, but when it was seeing the Bacardi building, it's in downtown Havana. And, you know, this is the sort of one of the biggest alcoholic beverages in the U.S., and it's an abandoned, it's not an abandoned building, but it's a building that's been converted to some sort of government use in Havana. But seeing the Bacardi logo and everything there in downtown Havana, I don't know, I found that really profound.
No, that is interesting. I mean, but I think what's interesting is that I think at the end of the day, socialism is the least empathetic, you know, social system. I think capitalism has a lot more empathy than does socialism. I think capitalists generally are far more benevolent, are far more generous than our people who are collectivists and socialists. I think the world has it backwards, and I think when you visit a country like America, particularly in the period where it was free, I think you would have experienced a lot more empathy than you would in some of these socialist countries.
Yeah, and so since after that trip, then I went to North Korea and to Burma as well.
Okay.
I didn't get as much out of the last two because I wasn't able to get as close to the culture, especially in North Korea. We were with minders all the time. But I mean, in Cuba, I was just there with the Cubans hanging out, speaking Spanish and, you know, doing local stuff. And so I even met one of Fidel Castro's daughters who was there just hanging out. But yeah, it was very profound to go there thinking a lot about Ayn Rand.
So what conclusions did you come from to away from Cuba with?
I felt really sorry for them.
Yeah.
I had one taxi driver that drove me around, and I was talking with him about capitalism and how important it is. And he's a Marxist taxi driver. He was really proud of socialism.
Yeah.
And at one point we stopped, and I said, "Why don't we go out and we'll get some beers? You know, I'll invite you." And he was like, "Sure." And so we sat down for a while. He ended up getting pulled over and questioned by the police. And it took like, you know, 30 minutes while I'm sort of standing uncomfortably in this place while they're finding out what he's doing. And so after that, finally, he's okay, and we go driving off, and I'm like, that sort of thing doesn't happen in capitalist countries. It really doesn't. And it was really jarring for him, and I think I actually started him on the path to thinking about capitalism maybe not being a bad thing. And this is a guy that was a fervent socialist.
Sure.
I mean, we were together for a couple of hours, but yeah, I mean, you've got to have this drive to make things better.
Yes, it's also at the very social level. I mean, socialism really destroys people's souls. It
right.
turns them into envious, miserable, malevolent people. And I remember seeing this more than anywhere else on the kibbutz in Israel. You know, the kibbutz is this socialist utopia. Everybody gets treated the same, no matter how much you earn. In a sense, you get the same apartment, you get the same food, you get the same television set, everything's the same. It's completely egalitarian. And people, you know, resented one another, they backstabbed, they gossiped, they behaved meanly towards one another. It was just a sick, sick social environment to live in, because it really has this profound impact on the way people view the world, the way people view themselves. You can't get self-esteem when that kind of in a world like that. So you're desperately unhappy. That unhappiness projects onto the way you treat other people. Socialism is an incredibly destructive philosophy for living as a human being, not just as a political philosophy, but as an an individual.
And that truly is the fundamental point at the core of all of this, isn't it? Is self-esteem.
Yes, that's right. Because self-esteem is the key to human happiness. You cannot be happy without self-esteem. And Rand's view is that the purpose of life is to be happy. The purpose of morality is to guide us towards happiness. It's to guide us towards living a flourishing, fulfilling, happy, successful life. And in order to achieve that, one has to have self-esteem. But to have self-esteem, one must place value on one's own happiness and one's own life. And the moral code of socialism, the moral code of collectivism, the moral code of most religion and most secular philosophy today says, no, you shouldn't really think about your own happiness. It's other people's happiness that it's important. It's the well-being of other people that's important. And you cannot gain self-esteem if you believe that, if you really believe that, if you really believe that your life, in a sense, is meaningless. The only purpose of your life is to serve others, is to make them happy, is to be a tool for their success. Then how are you going to get self-esteem? How are you going to get your own happiness? You can't. And at the end of the day, this is what it's all about. It's all a question of whose life is it? Is it your life, or does your life belong to some group? And what is the purpose of your life? Is your purpose of life your own fulfillment, your own satisfaction, your own happiness? Or is it to serve some other bigger cause, some, you know, the group, the state, the religion, whatever the other cause happens to be? Are you just a cog in some machine? And that is the fundamental battle between individualism and collectivism, between socialism and capitalism, is a battle for the individual soul of is my life mine? Is it to live as I see fit? You know, is it to figure out what rational values I need to pursue in order to attain self-esteem so that I can attain happiness? Or is life is to be, to just bear what, you know, to bear it like the existentialists, you know, just to live, you know, to fulfill some other greater social purpose or some other greater purpose in an afterlife? That's the fundamental question.
I feel better just listening to you. But let me ask this. I think Ayn Rand's innovation, I'm sure she's not the first person to have these kinds of thoughts, but her innovation was that she created a scalable, cheap way to teach everybody. You could, for $10, you can learn how to think this way. You might have to take a bit of time. I mean, it took me a week or two to finally get through Atlas Shrugged. But I think that's one of her big breakthroughs, is this amazing delivery mechanism that's incredibly scalable. But do you think that this has potentially enabled the left to be worse, because we have Ayn Rand's books there and pushing back and helping everybody move forward, but at the same time, it creates more of a struggle? I mean, could it even be more effective if the left got really powerful and then the whole economy failed totally, and then we're like, okay, we need to, instead of just the Ayn Rand Institute doing all this on their own, we need to have more serious support for the right?
So let me two things. One is, you know, I don't agree with you that her major contribution is the marketing contribution, in a sense. I think she will go down in history as a major philosophical figure. I think she will be 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now, I don't know when, but the day will come where she will be viewed as a major philosopher in the tradition of Plato, Aristotle, Kant, Hegel, you know, whoever you want to include in that list. You know, she makes profound, new, significant philosophical points that are life-changing, earth-shattering, culture-changing. She also, and this gives her the power, she also managed to deliver that message in novels so that it could spread much faster than if she'd only written philosophy and it had to be accepted by the philosophical establishment. If that had been the path she had taken, we wouldn't know who she was today, and these ideas would have to wait another 1,000 years to become significant. I still think they would have become significant. It just would have taken a very long time to get there. I don't see the downside, though, because I don't think that economic collapse necessarily is going to help the right being free, people who believe in free markets. Let's assume that's what the right is, because that's not the pattern of human history. The pattern of human history suggests that collapse leads to worse, that collapse leads to authoritarianism. Authoritarianism leads to a dark ages, and then there's a renaissance one day and the culture recovers. But it could take hundreds of years, and it could be a disaster. So I don't believe that for example, if we faced economic collapse tomorrow, everybody would say, oh, we get it. Socialism doesn't work. Let's become capitalist. I don't think that's what they would learn from it at all. They'd say, ooh, the problem is democracy and too many voices, and what we need is a strong man, and a strong man will help us. And then things get worse. Then they say, oh, The solution is not the strong man. The solution is God. We need to be better Christians or better Muslims or better Jews. And we need to pray harder. We need, you know, we need to enforce religious. And you know, there's nothing to suggest that people learn from experience. There's a lot of evidence to suggest people don't learn from experience and don't learn from history, particularly when history is distorted and perverted by the intellectuals as it is today. So I think what we need today is an intellectual battle, to convince people of the truth of the ideas behind capitalism. And I think the only philosopher and author who has a consistent philosophical argument to defend capitalism is Ayn Rand. So if we want to save capitalism, we need to convince people of the truth of her philosophy. And the novel's a great first step, but it's only a first step because while you and me read the books and said, wow, this is fantastic, you know, these ideas are great, most people who read the books don't get convinced. So we need a whole educational campaign around self-interest and reason and individual rights and individualism and capitalism to convince them of those ideas, supported by the novels, but supported by a lot of books and articles and interviews and speeches. And this is what we do at the Institute. This is the purpose of the Institute, is to provide that education for the culture. So when the collapse does happen, because I think a collapse is going to happen, an economic collapse, then people will have an alternative. They'll have something that they'll say, oh, yeah, these people were talking about this, and there is an alternative. And the alternative is I should live for myself. I should live for my own life. I'm not a cog in somebody else's machine. I don't want a strong man because a strong man – the assumption of a strong man is I'm not important. Somebody else can make decisions for me. No, I'm the best person to make decisions for me. We need to have that alternative in the culture so that people can turn to reason and self-interest as a solution to whatever problems they face. That's how we're going to overcome the kind of world where we live in. And remember that the enemy is the left, and the dominant enemy today is the left. But it's not like the conventional right in America today has any answers to the challenges of the left. Or where they do have answers, those answers are going to lead us in a good direction. You know, government has grown no matter who's been president, Republican or Democrat. Conservatives want to violate our rights in many ways that are different than the way ways the left wants to violate our rights. The enemy is all around us. The enemy, you know, and the solution is a new way of looking at the world, which is presented to us in Atlas Shrugged, a new way of looking at our own lives, which again is presented in Atlas Shrugged. But the battle is to educate people about these new ways and to get as many people on our team, or at least exposed to these ideas so they know there's an alternative before any kind of collapse happens.
One of the reasons I moved to the U.S. was growing up, I really looked to the U.S. as the place of, and I don't like the word freedom anymore because I think it has been hijacked and it has too much of a political sense. But I felt in the non-political version, I felt America was a very free place that you could really go and be great. And it doesn't it feels like that's changed somehow. And the America that we have today doesn't feel like the America that I looked at when I was 12.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I came to America in 1987. I was 26 at the time, and I think still in the late 80s through the 90s, there was certainly a sense that there was opportunities, there was a certain sense of freedom. You were left alone for the most part, even though government was huge, it was still very oppressive, there were regulations and taxes everywhere, but there was a certain spirit to America. And I do think that has changed over the last 10, 12, 15 years, that it's definitely in decline, and it's more – it's more evident. I think it was bad in the 80s, and I think part of why we felt so good about America was a certain romantic vision of the country that it even then didn't live up to. But I definitely think we're in decline, and the decline – look, Atlas Shrugged was written in 1957, and Ayn Rand already saw America in decline starting back then, and she said this is not sustainable, and she was absolutely right. The American spirit, that spirit of freedom, of an individualism, of everything is possible, is limited by the philosophy the culture holds. And when the philosophy goes bad, the philosophy is corrupted, the spirit is corrupted as well. And I think what we're experiencing today is that corruption of spirit. Americans are less positive, they're less benevolent, they're less energized, there's less sense of this freedom. And of course, the numbers play this out as well. You know, 10 years ago, America was the, according to, I don't know, a variety of different measures, and you can argue about how accurate these measures are, but measures that I think there are two different studies, one put out by Heritage, the Heritage Institute, and one put out by the Fraser Institute in Canada, that measure economic freedom. And by those two organizations, by the measures they have, it, 10, 12 years ago, America was third in the world in terms of economic freedom. Singapore, Hong Kong, and then America. Today, America, depending on the survey, is somewhere between 10 and 18. So it's declined even in relative terms, the amount of economic freedom that we have in this country. And I think that extends to other freedoms as well. You just feel less free, less, there are less opportunities, less able to do what you want to do. And there's less of that spirit of individualism in America today than there was in the past. And I think it's declining, and I think it's very, very dangerous and bodes ill of where this country is heading towards.
Well, I'm in the position now where I'm very well connected. I've got plenty of resources. I know a lot about what's going on in tech, and I want to be able to tell you that I'm seriously thinking of leaving. I'm gonna decide over probably the next 6 to 8 months, but I don't have to stay. It's easy for me to go wherever I want to live, and I want to be clear, telling you that it's specifically because of this spirit. I feel this crushing here that isn't in other places.
Where do you feel it's better?
If I were to leave, I would possibly go back to the Caribbean or potentially down to Brazil. I understand Latin culture well. I see those as countries that are growing. Now, Brazil still has this sort of socialist influence a little bit, but I think they're really getting rid of that now, and I think that they are strongly going forward. I don't feel the same way about it here. It just feels different.
So my view is, I think you're right. I think there's definitely something going on in Latin America that's interesting. I think it's not just in Brazil, but I think generally in Latin America, they've experienced statism in a variety of different forms, fascism, socialism, but just statism, the involvement in the state in every aspect of their lives. There's a certain intellectual rebellion against that among many people in Latin America. In certain countries, Chile, Colombia, Brazil, and some others, there's a movement away from that towards greater freedom. You know, I still don't think Brazil is anywhere near as free as the United States, and I think the numbers bode that, you know, reflect that. But it's moving in the right direction, which is nice to see. There's also other countries moving in the opposite direction in Latin America, Argentina being probably the more dominant one. But even in Argentina, there's a strong intellectual force that's rebelling against that. The challenge, I think, is this. I really think that at the end of the day, the battle for freedom is going to be won and lost in America, because I think even in Brazil and Latin America, the vision they have for where they would like to take their countries is America. America is still the symbol of what freedom means, of what economic freedom means, political freedom means. And if America declines, if freedom really disappears in this country, I'm not sure that the intellectuals in these other countries can sustain that spirit without America. Now, I hope I'm wrong, but I have a sense that when America goes, the world goes, and as one of the people fighting the battle. I'm not saying don't move, right? I'm just saying that as somebody fighting the battle, the intellectual battle over these issues, I still think that this is the country in which this battle will be won or lost. This is the country that is still the shiny city on the hill. It's the ideas of the founding fathers of America that are inspiring people around the world. And if they have a sense that they failed in America, I'm not sure they'll have enough strength to sustain them in their own countries. But that will be interesting in terms of the future, whether I'm right or wrong. But, you know, the intellectual battle for the future of Western civilization, everything good about Western civilization, I think, is happening right now, and it's happening in this country.
Yeah, I think the U.S. is important, but I think there's a lot of the rest of the world that's got a lot going on as well. And
sure.
I certainly see what you're saying, and, you know, we're lucky that the founding that during the time of the founding of the U.S. that the founding fathers, it was a libertarian time, I guess, and that the founding fathers anchored that to the Constitution. They did some very smart things, and I think it's been hard for the left to be able to break too much of that. Although it's hard, they do work hard at it.
I think that's right. I think that the founding fathers were so good and so ahead of their time in many respects that they managed to craft a document and a spirit and embed in the country a spirit that is fundamentally pro-freedom. And the left, and I'm not going to let the right off the hook here, and the right have chipped away at that spirit and have chipped away at that Constitution over decades. But it's to the founders' credit that it's survived as much as it has. And I agree with you. There's a lot in the rest of the world. There's a lot interesting going on in South America. There's a lot interesting going on in Asia. And I think part of what we're doing at the Institute is broadening our horizon to be more involved in some of the other regions in the world. So I'm spending more of my time, not a huge amount of my time, but more of my time in South America, in Europe, in, you know, somewhat in Asia, trying to bring these ideas to these other countries.
Have you been to China yet?
I have.
You've been to China because they're like pretty anti like other political speech, and so.
Oh, I don't know.
I'm surprised you get a visa.
I did a whole day long seminar in Beijing at a university on Ayn Rand, and the authorities knew about it, and they did not stop it, and it was with students and faculty, and we sat around for a whole day talking about Ayn Rand and freedom and capitalism and what those ideas meant. I'll also say that every one of Ayn Rand's books, I think maybe with one or two exceptions, is already translated into Chinese. And my book, the book that I mentioned early on, Free Market Revolution, the only language that that a publisher has come to me and asked to translate into is Chinese. So it will be available hopefully later this year or early next year in Chinese. So China is a very interesting place. I think there's a lot of interesting things going on there. I think there is a lot of oppression of speech, and I think if the authorities thought that Ayn Rand was a significant enough figure to threaten them, they would clamp down on her. But for now, they're letting these ideas spread into a culture that I think is quite receptive or has the potential to be quite receptive to the ideas. I also found – have you been to China?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I also found China just fascinating in terms of the energy of the people, the entrepreneurial spirit that exists there, the, you know, just the excitement of a people who have been held down for so many decades under communism, oppression in every aspect of their life, given even just a little bit of freedom, how much they can succeed, how much they can do, and how energized they are about that little bit of freedom. I found that refreshing and exciting, and parts of China felt to me a little bit like, I think, how the Wild West must have felt like in the late 19th century. It was just a...
I love China. I spent several months there. I interviewed a bunch of their top internet guys, and I'm a huge fan. I would move to China, but it's just my conclusion in the end was that it was going to take too long to learn the language and the culture, and that's a significant barrier to entry. I love China.
I agree with you completely. I love China too, and I wish and I hope that at some point they wake up to the potential that they have, and if only the government would get off their backs. I mean, it's hard to imagine how successful China could be if the government stepped out of the way. And unfortunately, I think what the government there is doing is kind of creating maybe the biggest bubble in human history. But if China could get out of the way and let that entrepreneurial spirit go, wow. I mean, it would be quite dramatic and exciting. But yeah, my experiences in China have been very positive in spite of all the bad things the government does there.
So what do you think about feminism? Come on, I got to ask it.
Out of nowhere, huh? Well, I mean, it depends on what you mean by feminism. I mean, you could say that Ayn Rand was, in many respects, the first feminist. If what we mean by the idea of feminism, the notion that women can succeed in everything that men can, certainly in all those fields, that where the primary requirement is engaging the human brain, Men have no advantage over women. And of course, the first real successful businesswoman in literary history is in Atlas Shrugged. It's Dagny. You know, Dagny, I mean, what greater portrayal of a successful woman is there than Dagny Taggart?
That was the first time that there was a successful female at that level in a book?
I can't think of another. I mean, I'm not saying it is, but think about, you know, how many positive portrayals are there of businessmen or women in any literary work in human history? But yeah, I mean, think about how successful she is there. I don't know. This was 1957. The glass ceiling was thought impenetrable. I don't know if you watch Mad Men, but yes. Mad Men does a pretty good portrayal of male-female relationships in American business in the early 1960s, right? I mean, there's a clear distinction there, and women are looked down on in terms of business. And here's Ayn Rand portraying a woman that's clearly more competent than 99.9% of all the men around her. I mean, that was a revolutionary perspective and portrayal in that book. I don't know of any other example. But it's not just in business. I mean, Dagny is to some extent the initiator when it comes to sex, has this incredibly healthy sexual view of sex and approach to sex. 1957, this is the height of sexual repression in the United States. Women were subservient when it came to sex and when it came to the initiation of sex or talking about sex or anything like that. Hollywood was very repressed sexually. I mean, in the movies, not in how they acted. So Atlas Shrugged is a revolutionary, and even The Fountainhead. These are books that are revolutionary in terms of the way they portray strong women. They're just, you don't see any examples of this. Now, if one means by feminism that there's no difference between men and women, or that women have a logic that's different than male logic or superior to male logic, or then I disagree. I disagree that there are no differences. I think there are differences between men and women. I think Ayn Rand thought there were differences between men and women. But I also think that logic and reason are logic and reason, and there's no difference in the ability of women to think and the ability of men to think. So I disagree with much of modern feminism, which has become another form of collectivism and another form of kind of subjectivism, kind of postmodernism. But I think that in the fundamental sense of strong women, women being successful, women being able to achieve anything using their minds, I mean, Rand was the advocate for that view, and the best, the first, and the strongest advocate for that view. And of course, let's not forget, she was a woman.
Yeah, I think your views have summed up mine quite accurately. And I'll add one thing, is that I think Ayn Rand was the woman that taught me how to be a man.
I think that's right. And I happen to agree with much of Rand's psychological theory about men and women and about femininity and masculinity. But I don't think that's part of her philosophy. So I know a lot of people who agree with her philosophy who disagree about her views about femininity and masculinity, you know, and that's okay. That's a scientific question in psychology, not in philosophy.
So Nathaniel Brandon is someone that I'm sure you're quite familiar with, and he's fairly... It's a complicated area, but he's written a lot about after the break with Ayn Rand and some of the problems. And I like Ayn Rand a lot, but I agree. I think there are some problems with it. One of the things that he just talks about is encouraging repression, and he's written quite a bit on this. I'm curious as to your thoughts on the potential repression in Ayn Rand.
So I think there are a lot of people who take Ayn Rand seriously who are repressed. I don't think there's anything in the philosophy that suggests repression. I certainly have never been a repressed guy. I'm a pretty passionate person, emotional. Emotions are important. They're how we experience life. I don't think there's anything in the philosophy that's anti-emotion as that. I don't think the philosophy is a repressed philosophy. I think some people who have adopted the philosophy, are oppressed and have given it a bad name. And I think more than anybody else, that's true of Nathaniel Brandon, who I think was a repressed person, who instigated when he was involved with objectivism and was the leader of the objectivist movement, I think instigated a kind of very repressive tone to the philosophy and to the movements. I don't think that exists today. I don't think it should exist. I don't think the philosophy demands it or requires it or encourages it. I just don't see it. I never understood what he was talking about when he talked about the damage that the books cause people. I never experienced that damage. And I think you know, the good people and bad people in every movement, and the good people and bad people within the objectivism.
What do you think about the Atlas Society? And just so to kind of give some background, the Atlas Society is, I guess, along the lines of Ayn Rand, but with a split, effectively saying that the some of Ayn Rand's views should be modernized, whereas the Ayn Rand Institute wants to stay focused around what Ayn Rand's beliefs are.
Well, the fundamental question is this. Put aside any philosophical disagreements we might have about actual philosophy, the fundamental disagreement is this. What is objectivism? Now, objectivism is the philosophy of Ayn Rand. It's the philosophy that Ayn Rand articulated. And she made a very clear request towards the end of her life that objectivism be considered that which she articulated, her ideas as presented in her writings. Right, wrong, meet in the middle, whatever. That's what objectivism is. And even if there are flaws in it, and somebody is smart enough to correct those flaws, she said, just don't call that objectivism. Call it Joe's new theory, or Joe's building on objectivism, or Joe's interpretation of it. That's our view. Our view is objectivism is what Ayn Rand said. That's it. And objectivism doesn't equal truth. Objectivism is what Ayn Rand said. And a lot of what Yaron Brooks says, a lot of what I say, is not objectivism. It's my interpretation of it. It's my building upon it. It's my views based on objectivism. But it's not part of the philosophy, because that's how she requested it. I view this as a property rights issue. She requested that objectivism be what she said it was. Fine. David Kelly, who runs the Atlas Society, and the Atlas Society is built around the notion that no, objectivism is whatever we decide it is. And if we think there's a flaw in a system and we fix it, then that's now objectivism. If we disagree with her on something and we want to interpret objectivism differently than she did, then that is now objectivism. In other words, objectivism can be whatever we decide it is going to be, you know, as long as some supposed basic principles are held constant. You know, I think that's a fraudulent position to hold. I consider that fraud. You're using her terminology, her name, her philosophy in order to articulate your ideas, and you're couching it with her name. Separate the two. Ayn Rand said X. You know what? I disagree with some of what she said. This is my point of view, but I'm not selling it. I'm not pitching it. I'm not trying to convince you that that's hers, using her name and the credibility she's built in order to sell it. What we do at the Institute is we separate the two out, and we make distinctive our views versus what her views are. And I think that makes all the difference, so that we can preserve clearly what objectivism, as Ayn Rand presented it, is, and what our views are. And if people discover that she's made mistakes, then fine. Let's move on. But those corrections are the person who corrected it. It's not Ayn's.
And there's another group that did the same thing, and it's called the Constitution. And it was written, and that's what we have. And that does get modified a little bit, but not much. And we keep it, and that's our Constitution, and it served us pretty well. And I think I agree with everything you're saying.
I think that's right. And look, if I disagree with some stuff in the Constitution, but I don't say, oh no, what the Founding Fathers really meant, or what they should have, you know, the Founding Fathers did what they did. If I want a different Constitution, if I want to improve on their Constitution, I need to stake it on my name. It's not Thomas Jefferson's anymore. It's Yaron's Constitution. So, you know, let's give credit where credit is due. and not try to sell our ideas as if they are somebody else's ideas, and gain credibility of the other person to our ideas. I think it's a form of fraud, and that's why, for those listeners who know, we will have nothing to do with the Atlas Society for exactly that reason. We consider them, in a sense, presenting themselves in a fraudulent way.
You want to tell me about your book?
So my book, it's called Free Market Revolution, and it's really a book that answers the question of, it sets it up like this. It says, look, capitalism works. We know this. So take your experiences. You know, we can go to Cuba and we can look at the success of socialism in providing the good life, and we can look at Hong Kong, or we can look at the United States, and we can see the difference. We can see the difference in standard of living. We can see the difference just in quality of life. And there's no question here. There's no doubt that capitalism, from a material perspective, works. It succeeds. So the real question is, given that, why isn't everybody a capitalist? And because this is not that hard to see, right? All you need is a little bit of history and a little bit of traveling, and you can see it. And our answer is that no, the problem is that capitalism is perceived by most people as immoral, as wrong, as unjust, as evil in some sense, ethically evil. And as a consequence, that taints their view of economics. So that taints the way they look at Cuba and the United States, and it shapes the way they look at the success of capitalism. And they don't want to study history. And when they study history, they study it in a distorted way. And when they travel, they look at the wrong things, and they don't interpret them right, because they're shaped by the moral code that they live under. And the moral code is a moral code of altruism, of placing the well-being of others above your own interests. That's what altruism really means. Altruism means placing the well-being of others above your own. Your life, the purpose of your life, is to serve others. Now, that is a morality that we are all taught. We don't live it, but we're all taught it, and we all believe in it explicitly, whether we live it or not. And that is a morality that, at the end of the day, is consistent with socialism and statism and fascism and all the variants of statism. It's not consistent with capitalism. Capitalism, at the end of the day, is about self-interest. Capitalism is about individuals going out there and trying to make their lives better, whether as consumers or as producers. Most of us are both. We have to be both. In order to consume, you have to produce. But we're trying to be self-interested. We're pursuing things that interest us. We pursue, whether we pursue products that are good for us, whether we pursue careers that are good for us. We try to do things that are self-interested. Businessmen try to make a profit. Consumers try to make their life better. But if we resent self-interest because we taught from when we're very young that self-interest is evil and bad and not moral, then we're never going to respect capitalism. So we try to make the case in the book that capitalism is moral because it is the system of self-interest, because self-interest is what morality should be about. And so in that sense, we kind of review Rand's view of self-interest, put it into the modern context of the world as it is today. We talk about the financial crisis. We talk about healthcare. We talk about regulations and taxes as they are today. And we talk about why all of that is driven by a false view of ethics, and why if we want capitalism, if we believe in capitalism, if we want all the material benefits of capitalism, what we really need to fight for is rational self-interest. We really need to fight for is individualism, is the virtue of self-interest, the virtue of living your life for yourself in a rational way, in a long-term way, pursuing your own well-being and knowing that that is moral. And that goes back to the point we made earlier about self-esteem. You know, doing that is what generates self-esteem, is what generates happiness, it's what generates success. So it's all tied together. Capitalism, happiness are tied together, and they're tied together by this moral code that Rand has presented us with, and that the culture, I think, needs to take seriously if it's going to save itself.
Awesome. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up? Because we're almost out of time.
I think we're good.
Well, Yaron, thank you very much. That was a really good interview.
My pleasure. Anytime.